Are we both doing the same thing? Are we both trying to make the other one talk first?
We can't start the show on that note.
No, I like it. It's Stag In. How you doing, buddy?
I'm all right. How are you?
What was your plan there? Because I didn't have one. I just wanted
I didn't have one either. And I was just hoping that you had one. And I'm like, we can't do the joke where both of us go like, oh, ha, ha, ha. We don't have anything to say because we've like played that joke out. So, basically, this is our last episode.
Bobby, just push the button.
I thought we had already pushed the button.
You're wrong with Ian and Bobby. You're wrong.
All right, thanks for pushing that, man. I appreciate that.
I like pushing all your buttons.
Oh, my God. How you doing, man? How's your week been?
It's been okay. What have you been up to?
What have I been up to? I've been up to a bunch. I saw Blockers, which I really want to talk about at some point in the near future with you, so you should watch that movie.
I really need to watch Blockers.
It's very, very socially interesting and a very funny movie at the same time. And one of the teenage girls in it who's like a super kick-ass character liked a bunch of tweets that I made about the movie, which made me happy. So,
really?
Yeah, she's like I looked her up. She's like a activist type young person. She's very cool. She is the Indian American daughter of John Cena in the movie. She's very, very good in it.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Why did you have to qualify that with Indian American?
Because it's an easy way to recognize her on the poster. I forget her character's name.
Okay.
Is that?
I mean, if you're comfortable, with that, that's fine.
You're such an asshole. Oh my God, I hate you so much. She was the best of the three teenagers, so. Really good movie.
I don't know why it has to be a competition. I don't know why, like,
she was my favorite character is all I'm saying.
We give these women empowered roles, and then we pit them against each other.
You know what's
happening? Do you see how that's problematic?
I think I'm trying so hard to not talk about how much I like this teenage girl in this movie without it being creepy that I'm coming off as, like, something else instead. So I hate you, and thanks for
pointing
it out.
And now she follows me on social media. I found her Tinder account, and I think
God, I hate you so much. I also beat God of War, the new God of War recently, which I very, very, very strongly recommend.
Ian, I'm pretty sure no one can beat the God of War. Wait, the God of War? Oh, is Kratos the God of War now?
So that's a very complicated question. He has, I believe, by the time this game starts, already killed everybody else in the Greek pantheon. Game is about him. This game
Even
is kind
Demeter?
Of. Oh my God! You are not allowed to troll me like this on the show. You're
what
allowed
about
to do
Hestia?
This.
She
You're
just
allowed
keeps
to do
the,
this.
She just keeps
no.
The heart.
This is a safe space where we both get to honestly talk about the things we care about. I hate you so much. So the original games are some of my favorites, and they are still great. Like, they hold up well, but they do have a kind of Mortal Kombat style aesthetic to them. They're just very 90s cool. I would say that this game is kind of what Logan was to the original X-Men movie. Like, this is like, it's
interesting.
Yeah, like the original X-Men movie is really fun and it's really stylized and really cool and very 90s. And this is like a very, very, like, it definitely exists in the same world, but it's very, very complex and quiet. And interesting. It's a really good game. It's also a really good game. It has minor elements of Dark Souls to it, but not in a way that gets annoying. And it's just really great beat 'em up gameplay. I can't talk enough about it. So yeah,
you just sold the shit out of it.
Yeah, it's great.
I think that was a good analogy. And if it ends up being a false analogy, I'll be so heartbroken.
I don't think it is. I think it's a very fair analogy, and I think you'll enjoy the game very much. About you? What have you been up to?
On the video game front, I found this fun YouTube channel called, I don't know what the YouTube channel is called. I'm really not prepared. But the series that this channel does is called Boundary Break. And what this guy does is he'll take games and then he'll like zoom the camera out to show like the boundaries of the game world. Like, the, you know, it'll show like the box that you're allowed to like play in, and then like what exists beyond the boundaries that mm-hmm. you can't see, and it mm-hmm. kind of like gives you an insight into how games work and how games are rendered.
Oh,
and
cool.
It's really, really interesting. Like I just watched the Pokemon Snap one, and it was really interesting, like what disappears, or like Diglett like goes under the ground and then shrinks to like save on processing space, but
whoa,
he's still
weird.
There. Like
that's
things
so
like that.
Weird, yeah.
Yeah. The one that really blew me away is Mario Kart 8. The world, that's the most impressive one because it's like what you see is what you get, kind of. Like there aren't many tricks, because I guess there really can't be a ton of tricks since everyone's constantly accessing all parts of that map.
Right, right, right.
But then when you zoom out, like he zoomed out on the Mute City map in Mario Kart, and like all of Mute City is rendered, and then all of like the desert area next to Mute City is rendered too. It's just cool. I don't like you
no,
should
no,
just
no.
look at Boundary
this is,
Break.
This is super fascinating to me. I think the thing that like captured my imagination most as a kid when I played a game that still had bugs in it was when you would like accidentally go through a wall or a floor and you ended up in a space that you weren't supposed to be in. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You see
yeah,
like
yeah.
the backside of water kind of. Like it was like this is that, right? That's what you're talking about, is those spaces.
Yeah, just things like that. Like in Breath of the Wild, there's an entire body of water underneath Hyrule. Like
okay.
shit like that.
Yeah, that's really cool.
You know?
Yeah.
So he has like several dozen of them up, and I would recommend looking at Boundary Break. It's cool.
Okay. That sounds really interesting. What yeah. brought you on that train of thought? Like, what took you there?
Something I read linked to one of them, and then I just, like,
oh, okay.
started watching all of the videos.
Just a random rabbit hole. Yeah. I also have, since I beat God of War, invented the best version of endorphin creating media consumption I've ever experienced in my life. Can I tell you about it?
Yes, I can't wait. I cannot wait.
So I bought Monster Hunter, which, have you ever played any of the Monster Hunter games?
I've not actually
okay
played any
so
of the Monster Hunter
do
games.
You know what the basic premise is?
It's like a gritty realistic Pokemon.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. No, I mean it essentially is just, it's just nothing but boss fights. There's almost no story. It's just progression. So you just kill monsters so you can get good armor to get stronger, to kill stronger monsters to get better armor, etc. Like, it's just a straight progression. But it's every element of customizability you could possibly imagine. So there's 12 different types of weapons. Each one is a completely different fighting style. There's guns, there's bow and arrows, there's, you know, quick swords, there's huge heavy swords, there's tank weapons, like all kinds of stuff. And then
can you defeat monsters with fisticuffs?
There are like fist glove weapons, I believe, too. Yes, I think. You also can kill them directly, or you can break off pieces of them, or you can lay traps, or you can poison your arrows or projectiles or whatever. I mean, it's just like a super complex game, and every monster, of which there are hundreds, has a different set of armor that you can build based on their materials. So it's just like a very mindless, very, very like deep game, but there's no real cutscenes, there's no real story. So when I get tired of that game, I start watching West Wing, because I started rewatching West Wing, which is one of my favorite old shows. It's a comfort food for me. And then while I'm playing the game, I have been listening to the West Wing Weekly podcast, which is a podcast where they go week by week through the episodes of the show. And I think I invented the speedball of media consumption. I can't get enough of this combination of things. So I think I've basically gone full Abed in terms of how I deal with the world, is what I'm trying to say.
It's like, it's peak something. I can't quite figure out what it is. I'm like, is it peak?
Maybe it's peak ADD. I don't know, but it's definitely
peak
something.
No, no, no. But just like I figured out the best way to play video games and mainline Aaron Sorkin at the same time. Like, I don't know if it's peak millennial, if it's like peak white male intellectual. Like,
yeah.
I don't know what it is, but I'm like, when you told, like, you're telling me this, and I'm like, okay, good for you, buddy.
What's your relationship with Aaron Sorkin? I'm actually very curious.
We're friends.
We've never really talked about
just,
that.
Just,
you know,
just
you
friends.
Understand. You understand what I'm asking. Aaron Sorkin's a complicated figure in the liberal landscape, for good reason, I think.
Aaron Sorkin's like one of those dudes who I don't think I like a ton, but I like him enough. But then, like, I don't know. Like, Social Network is one of my favorite movies.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, even Molly's Game, which I kind of, like, rolled my eyes and dragged my feet to watching, I really liked.
I need to see it. I still haven't actually seen that. I'm a little embarrassed to say.
I think I liked everything I've seen from Aaron Sorkin. Yeah. Like, I don't know. I think I carry, like, an unreasonable prejudice toward him for some reason.
I don't think it's unreasonable. I mean, his stuff is problematic. I would say, I mean, do you have a show or something or a movie, some old thing that you like that's comforting to you, even though you know there's aspects of it that are kind of fucked up? Like, that's what West Wing is to me. I mean, all of his stuff is like that to me. He feels like comfort food, and... You know,
I could watch Social Network, like, literally all day.
I mean, I'm saying I like his probably least favorite show among fans and among non-fans.
Studio 60?
Studio 60. I'm a apologist for Studio 60. And I fully understand the problems with Studio 60 as well. So I just kind of don't care. I will say, rewatching West Wing, there's some real kind of messed up misogynist storylines in the beginning of that show. That series starts with Rob Lowe's character trying to save a prostitute from herself who, like, clearly doesn't want that. And then like, by episode 10, he's, like, doing shitty stuff and going to her for, like, you know, information and things like that. There's some aspects to it that definitely do not age well. But
That sounds like the first season of House of Cards.
Yeah, it kind of does, except it's, like, she's not a character, so it's even more disrespectful. Have you ever watched West Wing, like, in any kind of seriousness?
In high school, my civics teacher gave us, like, extra credit for watching West Wing.
Okay.
And so I watched a bunch of West Wing in high school, but nothing, like... I never, like, sat down with the DVD and binge-watched it or anything. I just watched whatever was on in the afternoon after school.
I think part of what's attractive about West Wing for me is that it started 2 years before 9/11, and I think 9/11 just is still... We're still suffering from the after effects of how that broke politics in our country, and
right. It
just feels... It feels like the liberals' version of Make America Great Again. Like, it feels very comforting.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Like, it's ignoring...
No, it very much makes sense.
It's ignoring a lot of the things that actually are problems, but it's still, like, very relaxing. I don't know. I guess all I mean to say is I can still be a woke person in, like, Aaron Sorkin, right? Question mark.
I mean...
I know. That was a joke question.
It's weird because, like, Aaron Sorkin definitely gets a rap for being problematic, and he is, like, he also shows a certain self-awareness sometimes where I'm like, I don't know what I'm trying to say about Aaron Sorkin.
I agree. He's complicated, I think, is what we're both trying to say about Aaron Sorkin.
Yeah.
All right, so that's the West Wing podcast for this week. We'll talk to you next time, guys.
I've been watching, so Netflix, I told you about this briefly, but... So they just released a remixed version of season 4 of Arrested Development, which season 4 is a season that a lot of people didn't like very much. And I kind of liked season 4. I was fine with season 4. But season 4, for anyone who doesn't know, while Arrested Development, you know, the original series that was on Fox was very much built around this, like, very large, fun cast. Because of scheduling difficulties, season 4 takes, you know, one character and focuses on that character for an episode. And when you take the whole thing together, it's kind of like a Rashomon of jokes,
yes,
if that makes
yes.
sense. And so I think a lot of people maybe unfairly identified that as the problem of season 4, which I'm not sure that specifically was the problem of season 4.
I'm not sure it is either. I like season 4. I don't remember it very well. I do very strongly remember there being some pretty racist Asian jokes in that season that made me a little uncomfortable.
Wait, what were the racist Asian jokes?
I do not remember. So, I mean, I need to go back and check. I could be totally wrong. I remember 4 years ago at the time, there being a lot of jokes about Asian accents. Like, there was a group of Asian characters in one episode who, like, there's a bunch of big misunderstandings based on accent jokes.
God, I don't remember that at all.
Yeah, I could be totally wrong.
I bet you're right. And so it's cut into, like, the standard Arrested Development formula. Like, it's totally cut up and reassembled. So things that happened at the end of the season in the original season 4 happened at the beginning and vice versa. And Ron Howard had to go back and record a ton of new voiceover.
Oh, wow.
String everything together. it goes from 15 episodes to 22 episodes. So there are, because the episodes are shorter, there are 7 more episodes than there were in the original
season. Some of those were really long then.
It's just very fascinating. And if you're an Arrested Development fan, I'm not saying even if you didn't like season 4, you'll like this. I would still recommend watching this because it is just a fascinating thing to watch because it's like a weird undertaking and I'm not sure why they did it, but it's still just, you sit there and go like, huh, you know, it's a lot of going, huh.
That sounds like, cause from what I know of Mitchell Hurwitz, like I think he's the kind of person who would be very comfortable giving like a middle finger to the fan base if they were asking for something unreasonable. So maybe that leads me to believe he also felt like this was the right call. Maybe this was his original plan or something. I mean, have you seen him talk about why he chose to do this at all?
No, I think he's drumming up anticipation also. Because apparently 5 is being filmed or has been filmed and is going to come out very soon. So,
That makes sense.
But there's certain things that, like, I don't know if you remember. There's a hotel room. There's a scene in their, like, hotel suite with, you know, initially it's with Michael and his parents. And then each time they revisit it in another episode, we see the scene play out and the camera moves a little bit and you realize someone else was there the whole time. So like the joke is that the whole family is in this room, but we don't know it until like halfway through the original series where we're like, oh, wow, that's hilarious. Everyone's in the room. But you see that entire joke play out over the course of one scene this time instead of over a season. And I don't know if that's better or if that's worse. It's
okay,
just
now I need to watch it again because that is interesting. I have a lot of questions about original intention, and obviously he'll probably answer those eventually, but that's very...
It's very clear that, like, the Ron Howard voiceover has to do a lot of explaining that they wouldn't have to normally do if everyone had been filming together, you know, if everyone's schedules had been more flexible. Hmm. So that's definitely still a fault of the season, but it's just interesting. I don't know. It's just a really weird thing to watch.
Yeah. Huh. All right. Well, I'm definitely going to check that out. That's super interesting. In about, 6 months when I finish Monster Hunter and West Wing.
Yeah. I mean, you'll get to the point where you can listen to a podcast and watch a TV show while playing a video game, right?
You know, my favorite, this is just a millennial thing. I tell the story all the time. When I was very young, I wasn't very young. I was probably in high school, but my brother was, in fifth or sixth grade. He, saved up his money and bought a used TV at a garage sale because my parents didn't like us playing video games on the main TV, when they wanted to watch it. So,
sure.
So he set it up in the TV room with my mom's permission, and it was in the opposite corner of the television. And I came home one day and he was lying on the floor and he had taken my mom's makeup mirror out of her bathroom and positioned it next to the TV so that he could play video games and watch TV on the big TV in the reflection of the mirror at the same time.
That's incredible.
Yeah. So my brother basically invented picture in picture, as a sixth grader.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
That's a great story.
Yeah. Yeah. He did that for a long time. It wasn't
I should
just
be
like
doing
a
podcast with your brother.
Yeah. He's much more. Yeah. That's definitely true. Hey, Robbie. So that's what's been going on with me. Do we want to move right into it? We're making good time today.
Oh, why'd you say it out loud? We have so much time to fuck this up.
I believe in us. Well, I believe in me. That's not true. I don't believe in either one of us.
All right, whatever. Go for it.
Oh, am I going first? All right, I'll push the button.
My thing is better than your thing.
I really need to come up with a new theme song. I made that in like 5 minutes. It was my first ever try at GarageBand. And
I made mine in 5 minutes.
Well, but yours is actually funny. Mine is only funny because it's bad. You can literally hear me click the off button at the end of it.
Is that what that is?
Yes!
I've always sat there and wondered, like, what is that? Like, I was wondering if it was like a drum set or something.
Nope. That's just me hitting the mouse.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And I'm sure there's a very easy way to take that out. I just don't know what it is.
My next theme song is just going to be mouse clicks. That's all it's
going to be. Okay. What did I pick this week, Bobby?
I don't know. What'd you pick, Ian? Do you not remember?
I kind of don't. I've been so into West Wing this week. Everything else has left my mind.
You picked a season 4 episode of West Wing called Bartlett Goes to Jail.
I will say really quickly, I said this to you already, but I do think it's funny. I have been listening to the podcast, and Josh Molina is one of the hosts. He's an actor in the 3rd and 4th and some of the later seasons of West Wing. He's a very talented actor.
Who's his co-host?
He's the co-host. Oh, Hrishi, how do you say his last name?
I don't know. How do you say it, Ian?
Oh my God, what are you doing to me today?
You listen to this podcast all the time.
What's his name? Is their first names.
What's his first name?
I don't know. Oh, her first name is Hrishi. I just said that.
Is it?
Yeah. Wait, do you not know his name? You're a fan of this guy.
No, it's Hrishikesh Shirway, but isn't his name Hrishikesh? Or does he go by Rishi?
Josh at least always calls him Rishi.
That might be a thing. I don't know.
Okay.
I'm starting to doubt whether
or not I know. Way to attack me and then immediately feel guilty. Anyway, the very small joke I was going to make before you dragged it out for 5 minutes was Josh Molina always just calls his character Bartlett. And it was like really, really irking me that he wasn't calling him President Bartlett because I have such a fond place in my heart for these characters. And I'm like, no, but that's insane. Like, he's not real. That's crazy. And so I just like ignored it. And then last night I was listening to an episode and it started with Josh Molina saying, so we've gotten a lot of mail from people who have a problem with me calling him Bartlett. So I'm going to try to call him President Bartlett from now on. And I really apologize to everyone about that.
That's so weird because like I hardly refer to our presidents as president.
Right.
I call him Trump.
I think
that's
why I like the show is because the show actually makes you feel like you should be calling him President Bartlett. There's a fantasy about the like kind of Camelot of
where we all kind of bend the knee to our ruler,
but because we want to, because he's like the friendly grandpa that everybody loves and knows is going to take care of you. Like
that's not propaganda at all.
No,
that's
it totally like, is. It's just also comforting.
You know, I dream of a better time where we were all a little more respectful of our rulers and we didn't question authority as much. You know,
okay, now
the
I'm
golden
eventually,
age of America.
Now I'm eventually picking West Wing because I don't think you understand what that show feels like. Anyway,
I've watched West
my
Wing.
My pick for this week is Preacher. I picked the second season premiere of the TV show Preacher. You watched it yesterday, and the only thing you said was at about 10 o'clock at night, you wrote me a text message that said, oh my God, Preacher is dark.
It's really fucking dark.
That's basically the... So did you like it?
Yeah, I did.
Okay, great. So interesting. So here's the thing. At the end of this episode, I'm going to give you a pick for next week that's related to this one. It is a comic book written by the guy who also wrote Preacher. And I'm more scared of that, I will say. Preacher and this comic book, which I will announce at the end, are... Garth Ennis has a very, very, very brutal sense of humor. And I think the show makes that a little more palatable. So the fact that you're reacting strongly to the show leads me to believe you're going to have some problems with the comic. But we'll get there when we get there.
No.
I was going to just say, why don't you tell me a little bit about what happens in the show and what you thought of it?
Okay, so I will tell you, there's an opening sequence where the episode, and I don't know how much this applies to the series or the season as a whole, but it's set up like a road trip story. You know, you have three people in a car, Jesse, Tulip, and Cassidy, and they're searching for God. And so like the first couple minutes are just kind of like fun. It's them bantering, and then Eileen comes on the radio. And
the banter is funny,
you know,
too. They do a good job with the interactions and the personalities.
And so you find out a police officer tries to pull them over because you find out they are going 95 miles an hour down the highway. And they decide to outrun the cops instead of pull over. Mm-hmm. And so the big like all-encompassing needle drop that we were waiting for happens where like Come On Eileen takes over. You know, all of the sound.
Yes.
You know, like when a song comes on a radio, you're waiting for that moment where like
for it to go from diegetic to full score.
Right. And so it does. And they do this this really fun chase scene and then they run out of gas. And so
like immediately. Which she warns him about at the start. By the way, the only reason they run is because they're bored.
And they are all Very fun to watch. Like, they've got a good chemistry, they've got a good banter.
You know, Dominic Cooper and Ruth Negga started dating on this show. Yeah, yes, they're both very, very talented in the I would say the chemistry is very well done. And I love Cassidy. Cassidy ends up being one of the most complex and interesting characters in the comic book, and I think they're doing that. They're leading him in that direction very well in the show.
There's a sequence with Cassidy at the end of this episode that is very funny. So the cops pull them over, and they get ambushed by this other character, who I'm assuming is the antagonist for the season, or the series, the Saint of Killers.
He's just a big, supernatural, scary bad guy who...
Is he the Saint of Killers or the Killer
Saint
of Saints?
Saint of Killers. Okay. And he is basically invulnerable, invincible, whatever you want to say. He never misses. And he looks like a Confederate-era cowboy.
Yes.
I mean, he was a Confederate-era cowboy.
It looks very at home for someone like a Jeff Bridges.
Yes. Yeah.
To play this
He
part.
Basically looks like the character from True Grit. That's a really good way to describe him. Yeah.
He does. He looks like evil Rooster Cogburn. And so this is the part where I thought I wouldn't like the show, because while it's all blocked really well and it's very entertaining to watch, I think I have become hyper tuned into Collateral Damage on shows. And so what happens is all of these officers who are pulling these people over, who were breaking the law, who were driving recklessly, all get brutally killed by
explode. When the Santa Killer shoots you, it looks like a tank shell has hit.
And there's even a part where, like, oh, there's a fun little bit where, so Cassidy's he's a vampire.
Yes.
Right, so he can't be exposed to sun. Yes. Or he'll burn.
The rules of vampires in this world are that basically everything's bullshit, except you can't go out in the sun, nothing else will kill him. And if he gets hurt in any way, he can drink blood to heal very quickly. That's about it. He doesn't actually have to drink blood unless he's...
Oh, yeah. Okay. So that makes sense. There is a sequence with Cassidy where he's trying to stay out of the sun. And so he's crawling under this car that keeps rolling, you know, away from him. So he's trying to keep up. And there's a point where he tries to stop the car by taking, like, one of the dead cop's heads and placing it under the wheel as, like, a block. And that's where I sent you the text saying, like, holy shit, this is so dark. Just because the humor is eventually the car starts moving again and just crushes this guy's head, and Cassidy has to start moving again.
By the way, this is after a point. All of this is happening when they first get pulled over. Jesse Custer, who is the titular preacher, who can make anybody do anything he wants, starts showing off a little bit, and making people do what he wants. And Tulip doesn't like this. Tulip, the season finale of season one ends with him using the power to make her kiss him, which she does want to do. They're not, like, fighting or anything. But she immediately punches him in the face and is like, don't ever do that to me again. So that's, like, the last thing that has happened between the two of them. And
I have to say, my favorite part of this episode was Tulip's kind of, like, philosophy about when it's acceptable to use the powers and when not. And she ends up maybe even being a little bit wrong during the last scene. Like,
a little bit. I do.
Someone might not have gotten killed if they had moved on that quicker.
I do like, though, that there is a very believable and understandable character reason why this character with godlike power just doesn't use it all the time. It's kind of fucked up to do. And he's not a fucked up person. That's all.
And they even have since I think I'm very tuned into Collateral Damage, I was like, I don't want them to, like, get into a shootout with these guys. Because, like, it's very easy in narratives to make, like, bad-intentioned cops. In which case, it's fine to kill them. But, like, these guys are literally just pulling them over.
There's one
speeding
guy who is kind of made to look like... There's one guy who it seems like it's suggesting that he knows that if he pulls Cassidy out in the sunlight, he's going to be hurt. And he's very happy about that. Other than that, though, the cops all seem very innocent and just there. The point I was going to make, though, and I lost my train of thought a little bit, though, was the creepiest thing about that scene to me is that one of the things Jesse makes somebody do is he makes this very young, very innocent-looking cop sing the Yellow Rose of Texas, and he's like will not stop singing it as he's bleeding out on the floor as things are just exploding around all of them. It's a very, very haunting moment. It's played for laughs, but very uncomfortable laughs, which is what the show basically is.
Very quickly, it becomes like horrifying on purpose. Yeah. You know. But I was going to say, it's interesting because I was just like, please don't get into a shootout with these guys. And then Tulip makes the argument that maybe it's more moral to get into a shootout with them because then at least they have a chance to fight back.
Right,
you
right.
know? And I'm like, oh, that's very interesting.
And she calls his power his smoky brain hand, which I really enjoyed as well. Because there's absolutely nothing that looks like that at all, but it's just a really funny way to describe the word.
So the Saints of Killers, this is a problem I had with the episode. So they're being trailed by the Saints of Killers. They go to four different locations. Does that sound about right? They have four encounters with them. They have one where they get pulled over by the cops.
Can I answer the question for you? He's following the word. Every time that Jesse uses it, the Saint of Killers shows up again right after.
Oh, okay. Yeah. There you go. Never mind.
He,
I don't have a problem.
He finds that out in the second episode.
Okay, because I'm just like, this guy has a really convenient way of showing
that's
up
why he
when the
looks,
plot requires
that's why
to.
He looks into the gas station owner's mouth and rips his tongue out, because he used the word on his mouth. He said, you can't tell people where I've gone, or don't tell him I've been here, or whatever, so in whatever way he can sense that the power has...
This show's really
So, yeah.
I think it's legit the most violent show I've ever seen outside of, like,
I don't know if you spotted
cable.
It or not. Do you see at the end of this of the episode where what else is being held in the hotel they're staying at?
No.
It's an NRA convention.
Oh, really?
The next episode starts with Jesse calling everybody out to shoot at the Saint of Killers all at once, which they all do, and then high five and say, "What can't guns do?" And then the Saint of Killer gets Saint of Killers gets back up and murders them all.
Jesus Christ. Okay, so they go to gas station. He commands the gas station owner to pretend like they were never there.
Yes.
And you know they stock up on snacks. Oh yeah, because Tulip had to siphon gas through someone's intestines into her car.
which the next scene is just a smash cut to them in the car, silent, her mouth covered with gore. And a piece of intestine dragging behind the car as they drive down the freeway.
And then she goes, I gotta get the taste out of my mouth. And
the show's
great. She's just chugging like orange juice and hot sauce at a gas station to try to get the taste out of her mouth. And then the gas station owner won't acknowledge her when she tries to pay for her groceries.
Right.
Because she didn't hear Jesse command the guy to
and you can tell
there.
It's this moment of her being like, I guess I'm still in Texas, a bunch of racist assholes, like, just, and then they just drop it and move on. It's a funny little thing. I like that too.
Cassidy eats a cat also.
Yes, Cassidy does eat plenty of animals in this show. He does eat people. It's very rare, but he does eat people. The premiere of the show has one of the best Cassidy moments I've ever seen. Do you remember his fight in the plane at the beginning of the series?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I do.
Where he stabs somebody with a broken wine bottle and then holds a glass up to the wine bottle and leans the guy forward to pour his blood into it as if he's pouring it from a wine bottle. Very, very nice.
I do remember that.
What did you think of the episode?
I liked it. I liked it a lot, actually. And I didn't think I would.
It has a sense of humor about violence the way that Kevin Smith has a sense of humor about dick and fart jokes, which is to say it's not for everyone. But I enjoy it.
Like 20 minutes in, I'm like, I don't know about this. But by the end, it had thoroughly won me over.
So
but
how?
I will say
more
so than any of your other choices you picked, this feels like...
challenging?
No, one episode out of a larger arc.
Yes. Yeah, like, that's true. This was a really hard one to do. I more just wanted to give you a taste of the style of the show rather than anything else. Because it is a series. It's not really self-contained.
It is pitch fucking black. But I do recognize, it clues me in, like, it's a road trip narrative.
Definitely.
And I love those. Those are fun.
Which is what the main... So basically, season one of Preacher... In the first issue, everything happens that happens in the season one of Preacher. So, and then it starts with them going on a road trip to find God. So this is really where it kind of veers into the more direct concept that the comic book did. I think season one, they were trying to be like, oh, if this guy actually was a preacher with these powers, what would it be like for him to preach to a congregation? And that is interesting, but it's not as interesting as a cross-country trip with a gun nut and a vampire to find God, right? So it just, yeah. I just like season two more so far. I mean, I've seen the whole second season. Second season does one of the most bewildering and interesting character things I've ever seen, which is in the first season, the biggest mistake that Jesse makes, which he is still dealing with and trying to figure out, is he, in anger, tells a very innocent young man to go to hell using the voice. And the man disappears, and he can only use his powers when people can hear him, so he can't bring him back. And the B story in season two is that kid is in hell. He's trying to keep anybody from finding out that he's not supposed to be there. And the only person on his side is Hitler. His cellmate is Hitler. And Hitler, the whole season does all of the necessary work it can to make you feel bad for Hitler being in hell, which is a very, very interesting line to walk. It doesn't do it in any way that'll actually piss you off, but it's very impressive what they do. And the character who plays Hitler is really funny. It's really well done. The bully on their block, the bad guy, is a college frat boy named Bruce who's down there for date rape, and he's like Hitler's bully. He's like supposed to be Brock. It's basically if Brock Turner was in hell and was bullying Hitler.
Oh, man.
Yeah. I know.
That's like one of those things where you're telling me and I'm like,
yeah, I know.
Well, boy, I got to watch that to see if that plays out.
Yeah, it does. That's what I'm saying. Like, I mean, I feel like you and I have basically the exact same politics. I watch these shows and I think, where am I actually going to be offended here? And I think the show, maybe not the comic book, but the show does a very, very good job of walking that line very carefully. And it makes for some really interesting storylines.
Interesting.
Yeah. Where did the show win you over? You said by the end you were won over. What won you over?
I think it's going to sound weird because it's going to sound like it was like it's a really fucked up thing that won me over.
That's okay. We don't talk about it either. I just thought that was interesting.
No. So, yeah, the beginning, I mean, the whole show is pretty pitch black.
Mm-hmm.
There's a point where they find a woman in a cage who's begging for her cell phone. And
Go ahead.
Oh yeah, who is that guy?
He's a one-off. So basically, okay. We don't know much about Jesse's past yet. All we know is that Jesse used to be a wild boy. When we first meet him, he's a preacher and very quiet. We don't know why. So season three is going to be about how Jesse came up and why he's being forced to be a preacher. This is a person from his past who used to be a religious scholar. He's a very like hard-boiled, gruff guy. And when they go to his house, the first thing they find is that he has a girl, a very young, like a teenage girl in a cage in his garage, begging them for help and for a cell phone, looking very crazed.
Yeah. And my thought was just like, sexual violence might be where I draw the line.
Yeah, definitely.
Definitively with this. And so, Tulip and Cassidy are alone in the car and they react to this like, oh, what the fuck? You know, like, they're very disturbed by this.
And it's very much, the joke is that it's Tulip is more terrified. Cassidy is confused by the inefficiency with which he is keeping her captive, which says a lot about Cassidy.
And then Jesse shows up with the guy who's keeping her in the cage. And then Tulip looks back as if to shoot him a look saying, like, what the fuck? And Jesse just says, none of our business. And so you're wondering what's going on there, and you find out that part of this guy's like ministry is that people beg him to lock them up in a cage so that they can like help kill their sin. And so she's like addicted to like social media and like harmful like texting and stuff.
Yes.
And so he takes her phone away upon her asking and locks her in a cage, where she sits in his garage and like begs for a phone. But and it sounds like
it
she's begging for
it,
a phone.
It diffuses it so brilliantly because she screams from the other. Tulip's like, what the hell is going on, man? And he goes, "It's not your business." And then the other guy does. And then she screams from the other room, "Give me my phone!" And he yells, "You know, Jennifer, whatever. Do you want me to call your parents?" And she goes quiet. And then she goes, "No." And that's immediately when you realize, oh, this isn't what I think it is. It's like a really funny moment. I like that a lot.
And so, yeah, I laughed out loud at the reveal, and I'm like, that was the moment that kind of like won me over with its tone.
Sure, sure.
Just kind of like the really dark, unorthodox approach to like religion and morality.
This show, this is one of the less dark episodes of the season, I will say.
Oh, okay.
I mean, this show, by the way, I would say has the most affecting representation of hell I've ever seen on television, that I've ever seen in media. It's a really funny, scary, clever presentation of what hell is and what hell could be.
All right. I can't wait to see that.
Yeah.
But I like this, dude. I like this a lot. I honestly thought I was a scared because
that opening sequence. Did you just say I was a scared?
I was afraid, and then I stopped and said scared. I was scared going into this after the first 15 minutes or so that I'm like, I think I might like shit on this a lot.
Well, and then, I gave this to you knowing that it might be a risk. So I'm happy to hear that you liked it. I decided, you know what, it'll actually be as interesting for me if you hate this as if you like it. So let's just talk about it. But I'm glad to hear you like it. Do you think you'll check out more?
Yeah. And I mean, I know I've been bad at my follow through with the other ones, and that's just because I'm bad at watching shows.
I just like to give you a hard time. But I mean, if you eventually, you know, if this is on a goal of something for you to watch, I'm happy. That sounds great. I think you will enjoy the show.
This feels as much on my wavelength as like Better Call Saul or Gilmore Girls did.
Yeah,
you know,
for sure.
Like, I could see myself watching the show.
You know what?
Easily.
I forgot to do this earlier. We should do that now. I was going to ask you today, because we've done, you know, what, 13 episodes now? What is your favorite pick of mine so far? What do you think you enjoyed the most? And then I'll answer the same if you're willing to do that.
Yeah. You asked me this question earlier, and I looked over the list, and it wasn't even hard, because I just adored one of your picks so much, and it's not going to be very exciting because it's Brigsby Bear. It's the last one.
I
loved Brigsby Bear so
much. That's a good one. I was gonna guess Gilmore Girls just because that's the only pick on my list of things that you actually, given both of our tastes, you should have picked that for me rather than the other way around. You know what I mean? Like,
I loved Gilmore Girls.
That's like the only thing that's not even remotely superhero adjacent I think I've ever picked on this show. Mine, I will say, is still it's between two, and both of them were very early on, although I've liked a lot of your more recent picks as well. My second place was Steven Universe, and my first was American Vandal. American Vandal.
It's so good.
Yeah, that show. I mean, I you probably remember at the time you gave me an episode, and I watched all eight before you had finished the series in like a day. I mean, it's just a brilliant show.
I've been weirdly rewatching that show this last week with my mom, and it's even better the second time.
I need to watch it again. Yeah.
Such a good job laying down all the groundwork for how it eventually ends.
I recommend stuff to people a lot. I that's like a thing of mine. I know that being friends with me, it just means you're going to get a lot of text messages from me saying, "Hey, have you seen this? You would like it." Everybody should watch American Vandal. That show is really, really, really perfect.
Jimmy Tatro as Dylan Maxwell is one of the best performances I've seen on TV in
Dylan Maxwell
year,
is so good. His girlfriend is so good.
She has that a moment of that acting in that series that is fucking unbelievable.
I couldn't talk about it in our episode, and it physically hurt to not talk
and
about
we
it because you hadn't seen it yet.
Should not talk about it, yeah, but it's so good.
But it's, yeah, I watched that scene at about 2 in the morning, and I like woke back up and rewound it 3 times. Like, it was, anyway.
And how that obviously has to be like her audition scene, right? Because you need to hire someone knowing that they can pull off that scene.
Yeah, because I feel like that is a show where they had the entire script written out ahead of time. So that that makes sense. Yeah, I don't know. It should have been if it wasn't. That should be other people's audition scenes, like for real things moving forward. That show won a Peabody this year, right?
Yeah, it did. Yeah. It's great. I mean, like, it's great. And they're going to do season two, but with Peter and Sam. I think they're just going to be doing another case, which is the way to do a season two of that show.
Yeah, I agree.
But Madison, wherever you are out there, it's not Madison, it's Mac. Mackenzie.
Yes,
Mac. Wherever you are out there, I don't know your actual name, but you did a really good job, and I hope you get
What's her last name? Bobby. What's her last name?
I don't know.
Bobby. What's her first name? What's the actress's name?
I don't know.
Bobby. Why are you so disrespectful, Bobby?
Can I tell you a weird thing?
Was that fun for you?
No, but that's fine because I don't listen to a podcast about her. Like, I don't mainline a podcast.
I know the guy's first name. I know the two people's first names. The only reason I know Josh Molina's name is because he's Josh Molina. I hate you.
Can I tell you a thing that I was too embarrassed to tell you about American Vandal while we were doing it?
Please.
Do you remember Madison Kaplan? She's part of the Morning Show 9. She's the one who, she's Peter's co-anchor, and Dylan always zooms in on her boobs.
Yes, yes, yes.
I know who she is because she was, her name's Eileen, and she was a contestant on the Glee Project.
Oh my God, Bobby. You know what's even sadder, Bobby? This is the saddest thing. You have told me this.
I told you that?
Yes.
Oh man. She was a.
You just didn't say it on the show.
Ryan Murphy really wanted to have a Muslim character on the show. Mm-hmm. And she was Muslim, and that was going to be her arc if she had made it onto Glee. But
why do you have to bring up the fact that she was Muslim, Bobby? What's her real name?
It is Eileen.
Oh, Bobby, you don't remember her last name?
They didn't do last names in Glee.
Yeah, you know what else they don't do last names in? Fucking podcasts.
But you couldn't do his first name.
I did. His name is Rishi.
Okay, then you're fine. I have no problem with you.
No.
Here's your certificate, Ian. You're an ally.
Oh my God! But you walk me to this court where I have to defend myself, and then you start sanctimoniously patting me on the head and saying, "Yes, you're such a good liberal. You, is this what you want? I hate you so much. You're such a dickhead."
Oh man.
All right. What bullshit did you pick this week?
I picked Enlightened.
Experience wonder. Experience laughter. Experience sound. Experience love. Experience life. Experience lust. Experience pain. Experience Bobby.
So Enlightened is like honestly one of my favorite shows ever, and I don't talk about it often. Because I never think about it. Like I watched.
Was it canceled?
It was canceled after two seasons.
Okay. So it was canceled. It didn't end on its own accord or anything.
It did enough. Like okay. It doesn't feel like it was incomplete. It ends on a very complete note.
I have a hard time finishing series that I know don't necessarily end on their own terms. I've actually never finished Deadwood for that reason.
Deadwood.
Yeah, I always try, and then I get really slow at the end, and then I just kind of drop off because it'll be too painful if it ends on a cliffhanger. I don't want to deal with that. You know.
Enlightened feels like it ended knowing it was going out. Okay. I know it was canceled, but it feels like it completed itself.
Well, I did text you about an hour ago saying Enlightenment's really horrible, and you believed me, and it was a lie. It's not true at all. I just wanted you to feel sad for a second. I like Enlightenment a lot. I like it a lot. Why did you pick it? Or what do you like about it?
Okay, so I was thinking about this a lot, what I really like about Enlightened.
It's Enlightened? I'm sorry. I think I've been saying Enlightenment.
Enlightened.
Okay.
I've mentioned before, I think I mentioned during the Steven Universe episode, that for whatever reason, my favorite genre of story, uh-huh. of narrative, uh-huh. is like an ideologically pure person entering the world and trying to change the world by being uh-huh. decent. And Enlightened feels like a really fucked up version of that.
I texted my roommate today, who is very much a fan of this kind of show, and I'll name some other shows in a second that I think it reminds me of. And I said, this show is very much up your alley. It is a very dark comedy about self-help culture. I don't know if that's necessarily. I mean, I've only seen two episodes, but that is mm-hmm. my take so far.
I think that's fair. Yeah. I don't know if I'd call it dark because I think the main character's name is Amy Jellicoe. She's played. In a fucking powerhouse performance by Laura Dern.
Very, very impressive.
And, you know, she has a glorious meltdown in the very first scene of the show that is incredible. Like, it's funny and heartbreaking at the same time.
Which is the thumbnail. The best part of it, I think, is the thumbnail of the show. And every single time, I was watching on my phone while I was doing stuff today, so every single time I open my phone, I open to that thumbnail again. It is her with just her hair completely, like, all over the place. She's clearly been sobbing uncontrollably, and she is using every muscle in her body to force elevator doors open with just this look of insanity in her eyes. And it's brilliant. It's just like a really, really fantastic image to pick.
And so, yeah, the very first scene of the show is her just having this gigantic meltdown at work because she's being transferred out of her department because she has had an affair with her superior, her boss.
Yes.
Who's... Oh my god, he's a total fucking douchebag.
Yeah.
Played by,
so here's can I oh, go
yeah
on,
yeah
I'm
go
sorry.
For it. Go
so
for
I
it.
Think I think what I love most about this show is the question you continually ask yourself about whether she is doing this to herself, and she is like a very passive aggressive unwell person who has gained new weapons in the form of self help and new age philosophy. You know, because guess what? There's assholes who ascribe to those things too. Or is she a person who is trying to be better in a community and world of people in her life who don't want to be better and aren't interested in seeing her better? Does that make sense?
That does make sense. So anyway, but just very briefly, yeah, the scene, the show starts with her having a big breakdown at work. Immediately, abruptly, smash cuts to her having this spiritual awakening at a retreat in Hawaii, and then the thrust of the show is her coming back to her life in Southern California in Riverside, and you know, trying to, like you were saying, like trying to like kind of rebuild her life in the wake of both having her life destroyed and, you know, gaining these new spiritual tools that she learned on her retreat. I think the show tends to lean toward her actually wanting to change and wanting to change people around her. But
I would expect that. I mean, keep in mind, most of this I'm getting from the pilot. So she's at a very early... I mean, she does do things like in the pilot, she strong arms her way back into the job by threatening to sue them, which isn't necessarily an unheroic thing to do because she's clearly been used and tossed aside by this guy.
But
so
it's certainly
like,
something peeking itself out.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So there's a lot. That's what I mean. You're walking that balance the whole time. Or that was my experience. Even the episode, the second one we watched where she throws her ex-husband's drugs away, that feels like, you know, yes, that's the right thing to do. He has a problem. Also, she does it in a way that she hides from him and then immediately calls him out on it and then immediately gets in a fight with him in front of everybody about it rather than just being like, this was a mistake, I'm walking away. So there is, like, she is contributing to the insanity of her own life. That
she
definitely is happening.
I think
but
what's
I don't
hate about
her.
This...
I really root for her, actually.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I was going to say. I think the interesting thing about the show is it could so... A lot of it is very cringy.
Yeah.
But the show could so easily lean in the direction of pointing a finger and laughing at her.
Yes.
But the show makes you really root for her, and you want her to be a better person, and you want her to kind of, like, fully realize this change, even when she's just fucking up on the grandest scale.
Here's I think the mission statement for the show, or the snapshot of the tone of the show from what I've seen. This is, I think, the most indicative of the show. She has this amazing scene in the pilot where she sits down after coming back from this, you know, retreat, and she's gonna read this letter to her mom. She's gonna, like, have this moment of, like, closure with her mom about, like, you know, you can assume that they've had fights in the past. And her mom is very unimpressed by this performance. Her mom sees it as, you know, she says, like, I did things wrong, but you did things wrong too. And your mom, you can see her mom kind of bridle at that. And her mom, like, very immediately gets very dismissive of this as an act and is like, I can read myself. Why don't you go to work? Or whatever she says. Like, she dismisses her and then goes outside. That's a moment. Wait, let me finish. Because that's moment where – that's okay. This whole thing together, I think, is the snapshot I have of the show. Then she – by the way, I interrupt you all the time, so don't say sorry. what was I saying? Oh, so then later that night, she comes home, and her mom is in bed asleep with the letter in her hand. So there are these moments where, yes, the people in her life, she is telling them, I want to be somebody different. And they're telling her, we don't believe you. But they are happy for her. Like, they do want her to be, and she, we want her to be, right? Like, we don't know if we necessarily believe her either. But we want her to be better, and we want to keep seeing her try to make good choices. I think, you know, I used to go to this place called Ronald McDonald Camp a lot when I was a kid. It was a camp, charity camp for people with cancer and their siblings. I had a brother who was very sick growing up. And because of the tone of it, it had a very similar because of what it was a lot of hippy-dippy, happy feelings type stuff. And I remember the feeling of going from something like that back to the real world and realizing, like, oh, the problems aren't just me. Other people in the world contribute to my problems, and they may not be interested in no longer contributing to my problems. So all I can do is control who I am and what I do. And I think this show is about her learning that. Does that make sense?
Yes. I think that's a very good way to sum up the tone of the show. I agree with you.
So I just talked a lot, so I'm going to shut up for a while.
I think building on that, there's a heartbreaking scene in that first episode, which will kind of segue us to the second episode, where she goes to her ex-husband is Levi, who's played by Luke Wilson.
Really, really good, too.
I didn't know Luke Wilson had that in him.
No, like, me he's either.
Fucking incredible in this show.
Yeah, he's really good.
But she goes to his house in the first episode to drop off a book that obviously meant a lot to her on the retreat. And she, like, goes through this excruciating debate about whether she wants to, like, ring the doorbell or just leave the book on his porch. And then she finally, like, leaves it on his porch and walks away. And then he opens the door and talks to her and is like, well, why don't you come in? She's just like, yeah, I don't think that's a good idea. And you could tell she's, like, trying to maintain the purity of what she learned on her retreat.
Right.
And not, like, backslide into her, like, bad habits and stuff. But she really has this this affection toward Levi, and Levi obviously has an affection toward her. It's just, it manifests itself in really kind of, like, toxic, in a very toxic way, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, the second episode you had me watch is about them trying to reclaim some of the purity of what they had at one point in their life, and her achieving that for a moment until she realizes he's not on that journey with her.
It's only working for her.
Yeah, and that's when she loses her shit, is when she realizes. And that's what I mean. The show is about her having to come to terms with the fact that she can only make herself happier. That's all she can really do.
So let's talk about that second episode. Do you want to talk about what happens in that second episode?
Yeah, so the second episode begins with her thinking back. So I imagine the first three episodes happen very quickly together, because this is the weekend after she got back. So it's her first weekend home from her retreat. And she thinks about the things that she used to do on the weekend, which was, you know, make a mess of herself and get drunk incredibly and, you know, whatever. So she decides, okay, I have this really pure memory of going kayaking with, we find out that Luke Wilson is her ex-husband. And that was before everything went bad. A lot of dark stuff clearly has happened to them. He's taking hard drugs, and she's who she is. And so she calls him and says, I booked a weekend kayaking trip for the two of us. And he, very surprisingly, because the first time she calls him, he basically hangs up on her. She shows up in a way that we see as kind of crazy. Like, we assume this is another moment of her, like, you know, showing up at somebody's house unwanted. And he's already packed and ready to go. She expects him to still be asleep. I thought that was really interesting, by the way, because she's clearly gonna force him into this in a way that is not the healthy thing to do. And she's just lucky that he accepts, like, okay, I'm gonna come along. Like, that would have been a horrible fight, and the weekend wouldn't have happened if he hadn't already made that decision. I thought that was interesting. They go on the trip. There is an old couple with them and a younger couple with them, both of whom seem very happy. And that is something she thinks about a lot, is about her past and her future with this man. And then the rest of it, I basically already said. She finds his drugs. She dumps him, or dumps them, rather. He loses his shit at her and drives off, and she follows him. It ends with this really, really sad interaction where you find out in the episode their dog has died. It seems like maybe it might have been her fault, the way he's talking about it and the way she's reacting. I don't know if that's true or not. But he's doing lines of coke and in this hotel room while she's, you know, crying to herself and about to go to sleep. And then he very, like, druggedly asks, hey, do you want to fuck? And then she just rolls over and goes to bed. Very, very hard scene to watch. These two, like, broken people. Because he's essentially saying in this episode, I'm really happy you're trying to make yourself happy. I'm not super interested in that right now. I'm good with turning my brain off and not thinking about the world. And I'm going to use these drugs to do it until I can't anymore. Very, very just blunt talk about it all.
Yeah. And again, the tragedy is that they clearly both still have a ton of affection for each other. You can see where Luke Wilson plays along, you know, because he's very interested in her journey. And it's just so, I don't know, if that episode is just very, there's just like a lot of rich character stuff going on. Yeah. And
very,
also...
very, very strong character episode. Well, I would say the first one was much more of a comedy than the second one from what I saw. The second one is a very like poignant. The show So I was going to say this reminded me of some shows. The show kind of reminds me of Nurse Jackie in terms of how people talk about it.
Oh, which I've never watched.
Well, it's great, but it also is, it falls in that same line about like what genre do you put this in? Is this comedy or drama? And it feels equally silly to put them in either one. Like, and I don't just mean, oh, it's a dramedy. I mean, like, it is alternatingly really, really funny and really, really, really dark. Like, it's not a light show, but it does have moments that are very... It, you know what it also kind of reminded me of a little bit was Catastrophe.
Ah, that's a good comparison. It's interesting.
It's got kind of an indie movie feel to it, I guess is what I'm saying.
The Weeknd is the show does have a very indie movie feel to it. Mm-hmm. The Weeknd is a very sort of atypical episode of the show.
Right.
A lot of this show is weirdly a workplace comedy.
Mm-hmm.
So Amy gets her job back in seasons 2 and 3. She doesn't get her job back. She gets a job back, kind of like in the basement where they mm-hmm. shove like all their broken workers. And so she forms a very close friendship with Mike White, who plays, you know, her best friend in the show. And
is he the creator?
He and Laura Dern are
right,
the creators
right. Okay.
Of the
show. I didn't realize he was an actor in the show too. Have I seen him?
No, you haven't.
Okay,
He gets introduced in the second episode and isn't in the fourth episode
at
all.
That's fine. I was just making sure I didn't miss anything.
I would say by all means he's maybe the second lead of the series though, which is kind of it's kind of weird that I gave you two episodes that didn't have him.
No,
but
that's okay. I mean, I'm going to watch the show now. I'm interested. My attention is definitely peaked. Can I tell you something insane really quick?
Yes.
So this has always been a problem for me. I don't think I've ever told you this. I really, really like the TV show That 70s Show. It's one of my like sitcom comfort food shows. That goes in the same list as like Friends and Scrubs and, you know, the first – everything except for the last two seasons of How I Met Your Mother. And
I
whenever
– That 70s Show came out in a perfect – time in our lives for it to be comfort food for us.
For sure. Yeah. And it's a great show. And Luke Wilson has a recurring role on that show for a little while where he plays a character named Casey. And because of that, I always want to call him Casey Wilson. But there's an actual other person
named
Casey
Wilson,
who I'm also a huge fan of.
She's
so
great,
I almost call him Casey Wilson like every time I say his name. And I've had a lot of confusing interactions with people because of that. So anyway.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Do you have more you want to say, or do you want
to? No, I think we're good. I think we can move on to the next segment. I'm very glad that you like the show because after I gave you this was one of the ones where I'm like, oh, I'm going to be so heartbroken if he hates the show.
Well, I think then we did kind of something similar, which is we both did something that was a little bit of a risk, which normally I do tailor stuff more to what I think you will like that I also like. But Preacher, I honestly had no idea how you were going to react to it, so.
Oh yeah, I dug Preacher. I will definitely. I mean, it's on my list of things to watch.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. So we both did good. You're all good, man.
All right.
All right. So I am a genius, and I came up with a third section this week. I only say that because I almost never do. Bobby always does. So I'm very proud of myself, and I'm also very proud of myself because I asked you this a couple days ago. And usually, you know, when we pitch stuff to each other, the response is like, "Yeah, cool, that sounds good." And then you texted me for the next like 3 hours about your decision. So I was very flattered for you to have been pulled into the insanity of my idea as much as I was, because I spent a lot of time on it too.
Go
ahead.
So we are going to be talking about our top 5 personal favorite video games
of all time.
Of all time. And this was weird for me because I don't know if you were aware. So there was a thing called there's a streaming service for classical movies called Filmstruck.
Okay. Yes.
And,
yes. I am aware of this. I didn't even remotely consider this as something that I was doing at the same time for that reason. It probably was because it showed up all over my Twitter. But
Film Twitter started doing their Filmstruck 5, which is five films that changed your life.
I thought it was four.
Was it four?
I think it was four. I could be totally wrong. I just don't want to get
you could be right.
Text from people who are correcting us. So
we'll go with four then. Okay. And then video game Twitter started doing GameStruck 4, which GameStruck isn't actually a thing. But then I was really cynical about it because I'm like, fucking four games that changed your life. Like, I kind of take an automatically, even though I play video games all the time, I take sort of like a...
You don't like to be put in a box with your right. interests.
And my thought also
you're
like,
a rebel. You're like kind of the James Dean type. That's how I would describe
that's true.
Bobby.
That's
yeah.
true. That's true. I wreck my cars in GTA all the time. Yeah. And all right.
are you regretting the joke? In. No, I've done yeah, that. Was, no, that was great. I mean, it was fine. You're but, good, man. That happened
so I was just
quite
sitting
a long
on people.
Time ago. I think you're all right.
Because I was like, well, what the fuck are people going to put? Like, Mario has to be on everyone's GameStruck 4. And, you know, like, I was taking a very cynical...
It's harder than it sounds, right?
I was actually very surprised at how quickly my five games came to me. And how I could definitely point to how each of these games changed the way I look at games.
Yes.
Maybe not change my life, but changed definitely...
Or they added a new aspect to the idea of gaming, or just did something that, like, shocked you, or just something, right?
Yes. I know you told me not to, but I did leave Mario completely off my list, because...
Oh, I don't think you shouldn't. What I said was, Bobby said, Mario's gotta be on my list, right? And then you sounded very guilty that Mario wasn't on your
list. I feel like that's a stupid thing. That's like putting The Dark Knight on your top five favorite movies. That's not even a good comparison. That's like putting Pulp Fiction. That's not a good comparison either, because Mario's like a great game, but it's also like...
It's like putting The Godfather on your list.
There we go. God damn it. Why did
yeah.
I think The Godfather?
Or Citizen Kane or something. It's just like, well, yeah, obviously, like that's just what games... evolved out of, but that's like I understand what you're saying.
And so
sure.
like gun to my head, like, what's your favorite game of all time? I'd start crying, like, and ask you why you're putting a gun in my head. But then I'd follow it up with, like, I mean, probably it's Super Mario World or Super Mario 64. I just don't have anything interesting to say about them except
right.
for, like,
right,
they're great games, and I
and we already all
them.
Know why. That's the yeah. other thing. Like, there's not much. Yeah, I think that's fair. I will start this off by saying what I told you in text message already. If we do the same thing here that we did with the Disney Pixar Brexit, we just need to end the podcast, because if we have the same five games here, that's
I
very
think
sad.
They are.
I don't
think there's 0% chance of that happening. I think maybe we will overlap with one, maybe two games.
I was gonna guess one or two as well. You want to start with number five, and we'll just go up and defend our choices.
The way I'm gonna suggest doing this is we do a brief description of the game and what it means to us, and then we try to guess each other's choice.
Okay. Okay.
And then after we get to two. Like, if you have any honorable mentions, you can name those to make it easier for us to guess number
okay.
one. Okay.
All right. That's a good idea. I like that. I actually forgot okay. we were doing that. You said that yesterday. Do you want to go first?
Sure. Okay. So my number five pick is definitely the gamiest of uh-huh. all the games. Like, there is no narrative
is
at
it,
all to
is
this
it
game.
Alto's Journey?
It is Alto's... No. It's not Alto's Journey. When I think about, like, my relationship with video games... Like, sophomore and junior year of high school is a really big deal for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think about just, like, pouring unreasonable hours into a video game. And
really,
just,
really
like...
quick, if you want to picture Bobby and me in high school, I was really I was really into video games and really into comic books, and I couldn't shut up about them. Bobby was really into movies and really into video games and couldn't shut up about them. And we became friends and taught each other about the stuff that didn't overlap, I think, would be a good way to say it.
I think that's fair. I think that's fair. Even though, like, you introduced me to Kevin Smith, and that, like, defined how
Did
I approach movies. For,
I
like...
introduced you to Kevin Smith? I remember that happening yeah. the other way around. That's really no. interesting. I wonder
you
where
definitely...
I...
You lent me your copy of the Clerks DVD and said, watch this, and then that's all I could fucking
talk
about.
Oh, that makes me feel
years.
Happy about myself, because I picture yeah. myself as a teenager, as like a very scared teenager who would be afraid to show that movie to people. So
I just, I want to like reiterate, because we definitely addressed this in the first episode, but if anyone's just randomly finding this podcast, I think we both are fans of Kevin Smith the person, and we both hold Kevin Smith to, like, we understand the place
Kevin
his
Smith
work
was
had
very and, important to us at a time in our lives. I don't think we're in that time anymore.
No, we are not. Yeah. And I think we have, like, a healthy relationship with our past relationship with Kevin Smith, if that makes sense. I don't think Clerks is the greatest
movie.
We're
literally talking about this like an ex. I just want to put that out there. Sorry. Okay, but so okay. Number five.
So this game, I poured fucking dozens of hours on. I spent entire weekends on just trying to, like, nail the mechanics of this game, and I had so much fun playing it. And it also had me, like, rethink, like, a certain other subculture as a result of playing this game. And to my knowledge, it is the only game to date that has both Wolverine and Darth Maul as playable characters.
Whoa, I have no idea what this is. Oh, wait. Yes, I do know what this is. I only know this because Bobby would not shut up about this game for years. Is this Disney Infinity?
No, it is not.
Oh, okay, damn it. That's a
because
good,
that
that's
wasn't
a good
out
call.
When we were in high school. You...
Oh, in high school, I'm sorry. Darth Maul and Wolverine, I give up.
The game is Tony Hawk Pro Skater 3. And when I think about games that I really wish sincerely would make a comeback, like mm-hmm. game franchises that I really, really miss, I miss pouring so many hours into Tony Hawk. Like, those games yeah. are so fucking
sure.
fun.
I very strongly have a memory of, this is something that I still to this day use as a metric in whether I like a game or not. I remember going to bed at night and starting to plan out the next run I was going to try to do to beat the high score in Tony Hawk 1. That was like a sixth grade experience yep. I had. Like, I was thinking about, like, the geography and the layout of the level, and I was like, well, what could I try differently? Like, I turned the game off and my brain didn't stop thinking about it. That was a first for me.
And I just, like, and it also made you, like, look at things in the Portal did this for me too, but, like, you look at things in the real world and mm-hmm. you start, like, looking at them differently, like, oh, I could chain a trick from there to here, and I can, like,
yeah, yes, yes,
you know,
yeah. So this is going to be really hard because you just said Portal and I went, oh, fuck, Portal. Like, Portal 2 should be on my list, but it's not. Anyway, continue.
But anyway, yeah, I love, the only reason I picked 3 over 2 or 1, which would be anyone else's favorite, is because 3 is the one I got into.
Yeah,
I played 2 and 1 and they're also great.
I think they're probably the exact same game as 2 and 1.
Well, 2 added the manual and 3 added the revert, so those were pretty big deals.
I don't remember which one I played the most. I think it was 1. I think 1 was the one I really, really yeah. got into, but I definitely played a lot of them.
Yeah.
All right. Well, my number 5, unless you're, do you want to say
no.
more?
Okay. Go for it.
My number 5 was a really tough one. I almost picked a game that's definitely in my top 10 still, which is God of War 2. I considered picking the new God of War because I loved it so much, but I thought that was would be very disingenuous. I want some time to pass before I make a decision there. So I picked a game that really reinvented that same kind of genre for me. It reinvented the beat 'em up. It showed how fluid and badass that can feel, which is something that God of War also does really well, I think. And it introduced that to a open world in a way that I was just obsessed with. And the property that it was attached to kind of still to this day, I think, has given me real faith in licensed properties that I have never had before this series came out.
Okay. So is it my turn to guess?
Yes.
I have 2 in mind.
Okay.
I'm gonna go with Batman Arkham Asylum.
Arkham City. But
Arkham
yes,
City.
I really debated. I almost was like, well, I could just put the franchise. And then I was like, no, I can't do that. And I really, really like Arkham Knight. I think it's a great game. I think some of the mechanics bog it down a little bit. But I think Arkham City took the best licensed game I've ever played, hands down, at that point in my life, and made it even better. The flying around and just everything about Arkham City felt insane to me. And I think that invented the next generation of the beat 'em up. I think that when you look at games like Shadows of War or Bayonetta, even those types of games, they play so much into that. And I play games a lot for story and atmosphere, a lot more than other people do. I mean that's why I'm switching back and forth between Monster Hunter and West Wing, is because I need some story every once in a while. And Arkham City is so competent in its gameplay, but it's such a good story. It's really, really well put together.
I would say about Arkham City, a thing I there's it's crazy the amount of detail that's in that game.
Yes.
And this might be directed more at Arkham Asylum, I guess, for pioneering this more than City, but like what the Arkham games did is they made stealth fun, which is really hard to do.
Yeah.
Like you can play that game
and it made it
of
feel
winning
cool.
Enemies.
Like stealth doesn't normally work well because when you mess up you feel like such an idiot, but you could just swing out so quickly and reset that it just didn't feel like a problem. I mean, this is Arkham Asylum, not Arkham City, so I'm cheating a little bit here. But the first time I ever walked into the Batcave in Arkham Asylum, I actually made an audible noise. Like it just because I just never seen a world brought to life that I was familiar with already so completely in a video game. I mean, you have to understand, people who are listening now, licensed games just meant that the game sucked for our entire childhood. I mean, can you think of a licensed game that was good before that? The most famous GoldenEye, that's true. The other one I thought of was Butcher's Bay, the Riddick game that everyone was very surprised was good. But I mean, that's the joke, is that everyone was like, well, they're making a Riddick game. What's the possible value in that going to be? And it ended up being surprisingly good. So I think, that's it for that.
I think also Arkham City has maybe one of the best Batman Joker endings anyone could
hope for. I still every once in a while, scene is when perfect. I'm missing Mark Hamill's Joker voice, I listen to that that audio file you find at the end where he sings.
Oh, shit. Where he sings to him.
It's beautiful. I mean, Mark Hamill's a genius. It's an incredible game. There are definitely some. I know that game has taken some flack in more recent years, and I think probably rightfully so for its some of the misogynistic aspects of the story and some of the use of language in the story, but it's
took
overall
flack from
very
Paul
good.
Dini too. I think who parted ways with as a consultant on those games because of that game. Yeah,
I didn't know that. I mean, that's a good thing because that is something that's present in the game for sure. But I mean, that game led us to something really special in terms of how games changed in our culture for sure.
I had so much fun playing that game.
What's your number four?
All right. So my number four, this is a big Nintendo franchise making it onto my list. When I think about it, I don't know. I'm trying to think of a way to say this. It's very clear that a game from this franchise would make it onto my list, but I was surprised that this is the one I would have picked.
Okay.
But it's because I think this was the first game, the first serious game I played from front to back and beat, and I was really proud of myself.
Okay.
And also, every time this comes out on Virtual Console, I'll get this game, and then I'll sit down and accidentally play, half the game, because I get super into this game.
Is it Metroid or Castlevania?
No.
I'm thinking, because you said Virtual Console, are you talking specifically about the Nintendo Virtual Console?
I don't remember which. I think it was on. Let me be fair. This might give it away. I think it was on both the Wii U and the Nintendo 3DS Virtual Consoles.
I don't know. Those would be my top two guesses.
It is Legend of Zelda: Link's Awakening for Game Boy.
I'm stupid. Wow, the Game Boy one. That is an interesting one. Okay, so I love that game. That is a weird game. Why did you pick that Zelda game? Is there another Zelda game on your list?
No.
Wow.
This is the Zelda game I picked.
Okay.
Because the nostalgic, I'm being straight. The nostalgic
factor. By the
way,
I just realized, I'm giving you a big hint for future, I don't have a single Nintendo game on this list. I'm surprised by that.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I didn't think of that. I think mine are all defendable, though, so we'll keep going, but.
I didn't put Ocarina of Time or anything on my list. Link's Awakening means a lot to me just because, again, I beat this game when I was in sixth grade and it was a huge deal for me. I also like how apart from the other Zelda games it feels. The format of this game is that Link kind of just wakes up on an island after a storm and he's trying to get off.
Start talking to him.
Yes. Well, that happens in every Zelda game. But,
usually they're bird people, at least. These are just birds.
This is going to be a weird thing to say. I think this is one of the few Zelda games that really leans into the sadness of its story and, the stakes. Link is trying to get off this island, and when you finally understand kind of the secret of the island and what is the cost of Link getting off the island. It's presented as like sort of a triumphant thing, but it's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
like the ending of this game, I remember as a kid just had me mouth agape.
Do you want to say what it is? Because I actually don't know if I've beaten the game. I played it a lot, but I don't know if I've beaten it. I had it when I was young, so.
Yeah, sure. So you're on this island, and this island is filled with a bunch of quirky people. Zelda is not in this game at all. Ganon is not in this game at all. And you're collecting all these instruments to wake up the windfish, which lives in an egg atop a mountain. And so you play these instruments, you go into the egg, you fight the windfish's nightmares, and you wake it up. And you find out that this island you've been on is a dream created by the windfish. And so the windfish thanks you for waking him up because he's been trapped in sleep. And so he you know, wakes up and starts to fly away. But the cost of that is this island disappears because none of it's real. And so all these friends you've made along the way, there's a montage as this very like somber song plays and you watch them all get wiped from existence.
You know, I have beaten this. I do remember this.
It's really good. It's a good game. It's sort of like, I mean, maybe next to Adventures of Link, it's sort of like the most forgotten entry in the Zelda series, but I love this game so much.
I still do have, I have a lot of fondness for the top downs still. Link to the Past was really, really fun for me. I'm also a huge fan of the top down Wind Waker sequels, Phantom Hourglass and Minish Cap. I think is what they were called. Have you played those games?
Yeah, there was another one too. There was the train one, right?
That's what Spirit Tracks. Thank you.
Spirit Tracks.
Actually, I don't think I've played Minish Cap. I think I've only played the first two. But I totally accept that. Okay. So my number four. Oh, we gotta go faster than this. Okay, my number four. My number four is I had to put an RPG on this game. That was important to me. RPGs are a huge part of my life. I did not play Dungeons & Dragons as a kid. I didn't have any other friends who introduced it to me. I kind of missed out on that. And I'm sad about that because I think I would have really, really jumped in deep into that world when I was young. And I think it would have been fun. This game is the closest I have ever experienced to playing Dungeons & Dragons in video game form. Now, I have been told very recently that Divinity Original Sin 2 is probably an even better competitor. But I don't have that game. So this is another franchise game. I unfortunately have a lot of franchises on this list. And it's something that I remember just blew me away in terms of storytelling, in terms of complexity of choice, in terms of character interactions. It's still something that sits with me to this day. I've replayed this game probably every 5 years since it came out. Like once every 5 years I
I have a 2-way tie.
Okay.
If I get it wrong, can I name the other one?
If you get it right, you don't owe me that $10 anymore for last time.
Okay. Dragon Age Origins.
Yep.
Cool.
All right. Dragon Age. Have you played the Dragon Age games, really?
I've not. I've really not.
Yeah. I mean, Origins is perfect, man. It was able to do more with variety of storytelling and feeling like you had it. I mean, it is on tracks a little bit, but the amount of choice in terms of what you have to do and the freedom it feels like you have while you're doing it, it just felt amazing. And I've never played another game until something that's going to come later on my list that made me feel more like I was actually role-playing a character. The interactions between people are amazing. I still remember very, very strongly something that Dan Harmon once said on the Indoor Kids podcast about this game. There's that game has very pansexual relationship options. Basically, there's straight characters, there's bi characters, there's gay characters, and depending on your gender, you can or cannot hit on certain characters with those preferences, which was obviously very innovative for, 2003, I think this originally came out, maybe 2006, something like that. And I remember Dan Harmon saying that there was a redhead in that game with a really, really hot French accent. And he was so in love with her that he slept with the witch instead. like he didn't pursue her because he was scared of her. And I feel like the game makes you feel that way. Like he was actually it's a joke, but he was like nervous to talk to her. That's insane. Like, and you have these interactions with characters where like characters will sit you down by the fire and be like, hey, so have I been misreading this? Are you into me? Like, and you have to like accept it or let them down gently. And there's parts in the game where, like, you'll find something and you're like, oh, I remember this character said they like this, or it's a book that they loved when they were a kid, and if you give it to them, they're more likely to want to date you. Like, it's, I mean, that sounds very like on like a, you know, a person on the spectrum's version of relationships, but for gameplay at the time, it just, it blew me away. I still recommend that game to people all the time. It's also a great story. It's a really, really well done sword and sorcery world story.
It's one of those games that I knew I need to go back and play, but oh man, it just feels like a very daunting undertaking.
It's not as much as you would think, but I understand what you mean for sure. Okay, now we got to keep going because
yeah, we got to keep going.
So what's number three for you?
So I'll be very short. Three was a turning point in how I saw the relationship between narrative and mechanics in games.
Mm-hmm.
I really think the mechanics of this game, and it's not as much of a game as the other choices on my list,
mm-hmm.
really inform the narrative and are used in really inventive ways to inform the narrative. It is also an adaptation. It is my favorite video game adaptation of another property.
Huh.
And I think the game Heavy Rain kind of came out with like a lot of promise of being this like really choice heavy narrative.
Anything
could happen.
Yes.
And I don't love Heavy Rain just because I think that story was kind of shit. But this game fulfilled a lot of the promise that I think Heavy Rain could have.
I think I already know. Maybe I'm totally wrong, but I think I already
No,
know.
You go for it.
Is this Telltale's Walking Dead?
It is absolutely yeah, okay. Telltale's The Walking Dead Season 1.
So
I love this game so much.
I have never beaten Season 1. I have Season 1 and Season 2. I've never beaten it. I suck.
I mean, both of them are very harrowing, intimate experiences. It's really good.
I mean, from what I've played, the best part of those games is you can recommend them to anybody who has a console. Like, there's no real...
I played it on my iPad.
There's no real skill in terms of gameplay, so it's really just about intelligence and problem-solving and being terrified by a really good story, which is great, you know?
And you feel such affinity for all these characters. I honestly think, and I know this is, like, maybe sacrilegious, but, like, I even like The Walking Dead game better than I liked the Walking Dead comic.
That's
and
fair.
I really liked the comic.
I think you know? there's a lot of conversation in game development theory about false choice and how a lot of games give us these false choices, which is, you know, you can do this or you can do this, and there's no other choice, so you have to pick one of those two, and that's not really how people interact in real life. I think, and that's true in these games as well, right? But I think the thing that these games do really well in terms of storytelling is it really only gives you those binary choices when there's a timer and somebody's going to die because of it. And so it feels very real because you don't have time to do anything else. Those are the only two choices. And it just feels very hard and real. I remember like saying things to people in that game and them being like, that game actually really was bad for my social anxiety because I would say something and they would take it the wrong way, which is what I'm always terrified is going to happen. And the game was just nothing but that. It's just nothing but people being like, well, earlier you said this, and like turning it back around on you.
And I guess this is spoilers for Season 1, but whatever. Mm-hmm. It's been out for like a decade, so shut up. I always tell people the thing that is most, as far as the choices that you're presented in the game, you know, when you make a choice, it'll tell you, if it's a key choice, it'll say, you know, this character remembered that. Kenny remembered
right.
that, you
right.
know? And that'll come back to into play later on in the game. At the end of Season 1, your character is facing his demise. And you are talking to another character, and you're trying to give them advice on how to survive. And at the time this game came out, it wasn't necessarily a Season 1. We didn't know that there were going to be sequels.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're giving her advice on how to live without you. And you give her, you know, you get to choose which advice you give her. And the game tells you, you know, Clementine will remember that. And
huh.
you feel such ownership over those choices because
huh.
fucking the game knows that the game's, you know, the game's about to end. And
yeah.
you know, it doesn't matter if as far as the game, if she remembers that or not.
Right.
But those choices feel so important
but
because
her,
you
but
know that this character.
She will remember it. Yeah. yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I love this game.
My strongest memory of that game is in the beginning of the second episode. It's like five or six episodes long. I was walking through the woods unarmed with this little girl who was with me, and we found a guy in a bear trap, and there were zombies coming at him. Like, they were far away, but they were getting closer. And your options were to cut his foot off to free him or to break him out of the bear trap. And I tried to break him out of the bear trap 3 times, and the zombies kept getting closer, and it clearly wasn't happening. So then I panicked, because it's on a timer. I started trying to cut his foot off, and then I had to drop the axe and run after cutting his foot halfway off and let the zombies kill him, because I tried to do 2 things badly instead of 1 thing well. And the game just keeps going. Like, you can't... I just let that guy die. But it was a very... Like, I still think about that.
There's a choice you have to make halfway through the series. I don't know how far you got. Where you come across a car in the woods. Lights are on. It's packed with supplies. And everyone in your team freaks out because it's, like, free supplies. No one is manning this car. And, you know, like, they start raiding the car. And you start to go toward it. But Clementine, you know, this girl you're taking care of, holds you back and says, you know, I don't... Like, what? It's someone's car. It's someone's things. We can't take it. And you have to sort of make a moral choice
right
at that moment. And right. The way that plays in at the end, it doesn't play in like, you know, in the way of karma or anything. But you certainly feel what the consequence of your choice on others is. Just in the general human sense. And it's great. Totally. We need to keep moving.
Number 3. Yeah. What's your number 3?
So go for it.
Yep. Okay. So my number 3 is another franchise. Apparently all of these are franchises. This is the second, which would be shocking for most people because the first is considered very holy among most. I also love the first, but I think this is a better story. I picked this game almost exclusively for story, although I do think it's a very excellent and fun game to play.
Oh, Jesus. I have no idea.
It's a shooter, and I'll just go ahead and tell you.
Tell me.
I picked BioShock Infinite.
Oh, that is the third game in a series, by the way.
Oh, kind of. System Shock 2 is not.
No, there's a BioShock 2.
Oh, that's true. You're right. That doesn't count.
It's good. BioShock 2 is good.
BioShock 2 is good the way that you have to raise your voice to say it.
It's fine. It's not as bad.
Yeah.
As every... Anyway,
see how
Infinite is definitely
our voice
better.
And we said nice things about it.
But it's not bad enough to write it out of the series.
Right.
Man.
I think that Comstock and this story of probabilities and alternate universes and everything else that's going on in that game is just excellent. I also think that the extreme patriotism is really fun and interesting. I think as a history buff, some of the aspects of the kind of steampunk patriotism of the time were really cool. I like the fighting. I like the bad guys. I thought that game was brilliant. I think after the first one and the excitement of the first one, I spent so much of this game trying to figure out what I was... It felt like Lost in a good way. It felt like mm-hmm. I was discovering a world very slowly, and that I had trust that the world was going to be great and be really interesting, and that I wasn't going to come across anything where I was like, oh, that's stupid or that doesn't make sense. Anytime anything weird happened, I knew that it was going to be explained to me, and I left that game with just a big-ass grin on my face. Everything made sense. It had some really interesting things to say about gameplay and choice that were very different than what the first one had to say. What it didn't do was become a game in the, like, it was become the M. Night Shyamalan of games. It didn't end with this big, cool twist in the same way the first one did, because that's what everybody was wanting. Because I think that's the only thing people really remember about BioShock, and while that is an interesting element of BioShock, it's definitely not the only interesting element of BioShock. So
Infinite has a pretty huge twist,
it
though.
It does, but it doesn't feel like...
It has a huge twist.
You understand what I'm saying, right? Like, it doesn't feel like it's reliant on being...
No, not at all.
It didn't... Like, a lot of M. Night Shyamalan movies after The Sixth Sense ended with the twist being the only reason that movie mattered, or why that movie mm-hmm. being watched was worth being watched, and that's not what I felt like with BioShock, and I didn't feel like this without with this either.
I agree. Infinite's like a perfect game. It's really fun.
People,
it's,
just go play it. We don't even have to talk about
it's
it.
Really awesome. It's really awesome. I want to say the barbershop quartet music is really unsettling and awesome.
Oh my god, that
awesome
opening
too.
Yeah, the game opens with these floating cities and you're soaking in the majesty of it, and then all of a sudden it's 1915 and this barbershop quartet starts playing or starts singing Beach Boys songs from the 60s, and that was when I was like, oh, I'm all in. I'm so interested to figure out what the hell that means.
There's and a they moment explain later it. When great. Like circus organs play Cyndi Lauper too.
Yeah, yep.
It's like it's just great.
That was the original Westworld, I guess, huh?
It's a good game, dude. Yeah. That's a good choice.
Okay, cool. I'm glad because I thought you were gonna kind of come at me a little bit about picking it over the first one, but
I think it's more interesting to pick that one than the first one. I'm all about interesting choices.
Yeah.
Speaking of interesting choices, this one's not that interesting of a choice. Front to back, this is my favorite narrative gaming experience. It just dumps you into the middle of like this big ass adventure and introduces you to a giant cast of compelling characters and builds an entire game around you getting to know these characters, and then throws you into an ending where you could potentially lose all of these characters. And I just gave it away, but
I totally gave it away so much. And it's also on my list. This is probably our only overlap. What is it? Well, I'll just say it. It's Mass Effect 2, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
God damn it. I love Mass Effect 2
so much. That's my second. It's a perfect game. That game is just a perfect narrative game.
I've played that game so many times.
Me too. I've beaten it 4 times at least. And that's a long game. Like it's and you get something different out of it every time, and you love every single member of that crew so much. It's a massive undertaking. It's really impressive.
And I will even say the DLC in this game rocked.
Yes,
like Kasumi's
totally.
Is a great character. The Shadow Broker mission's great.
Yep.
It's awesome.
Yep.
Go for it.
A few years ago when I was still with my ex-girlfriend, she really liked some of the games I played, including the Mass Effect games, but she just didn't care about, you know, the gameplay stuff at all. So we started kind of playing them together where I would play all the boring side stuff and then she would make all the decisions in the main story. So she would like watch me play and then make all the calls. And it actually ended up being really fun. We beat the second one and started playing the third one in her, you know, version of the game, and Tali wasn't there. And all of a sudden, I looked around everywhere, and for whatever reason, in my load of my season of my second game into the third one, they decided that they thought that Tali had died during our suicide mission,
no.
And so there was no way to protect her planet from like there's no way to win in the best way possible with the planet in the third one, and we actually just stopped. We were so heartbroken that we were like, "Oh, we can't finish this."
There are few like companion characters.
It was because it was Tali. Yeah. I mean, it was also because like her storyline is just so heartbreaking if it's not done right. Like if you see the version in part 3 where she kills herself,
that is my like canon playthrough. And that's your canon playthrough.
Is that what you said?
Yeah,
that was my
main ship because
it's the most horrifying thing you've ever seen.
I had engineered two in a way that I could not resolve that conflict, and morally my shepherd had to go the other way. Couldn't side with Tali.
This
has been said, and it took me too long to realize this, but Fem Shep is the definitive shepherd.
Played Fem Shep once, and that was in the playthrough we're talking about. I've always played the first time I play a game like that, I usually play trying to play as myself. So I make him like as geeky looking as possible with red hair, and then just make the choices I think I would make. Then I try to do like a pure hero and a pure villain if I want to play again. So I made like a really militaristic guy and a really like hippy dippy guy the other times I played.
This game does have a choice where you can decide to kill one of your companions and her daughter can just assume her identity. And I did that.
This game also has a choice where if you sleep with one of the characters, you just die in the game.
Yeah, that character. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And that's a choice that does not pay off.
Who is your favorite Mass Effect 2 crewman?
Oh. I mean, Garrus. I love Garrus.
Garrus is my favorite character overall in the whole games. I think for 2, for me, it would be either Dr. What's his name? The Salarian? The nerdy
insect guy? Oh, Mordain.
Yeah, I mean, or Grunt. Grunt is amazing as well. I love
Grunt
both
great.
Of them. Yeah.
That whole crew, except for maybe like Zayed and
yeah,
Jacob kind of sucks.
Zayed's boring. Who does?
I said Jacob kind of sucks too.
Yeah, Jacob's kind of boring.
Everyone else is pretty cool.
Yeah. I really
love
like
Miranda.
Jack. Yeah.
I was boring. My shepherd, my like main shepherd, was faithful to what's her name?
My Ian shepherd, went out or slept with, I mean, whatever, with Jack. My militaristic shepherd slept with Miranda, and my hippy dippy shepherd slept with Tali.
I was with Liara through all three games.
Oh my god. You're such a most, dork.
It's the most boring thing a choice that one can make.
I always pick Liara in the first game, but, you know, kick her to the curb, right?
No, Liara's the best.
I'm kidding. I respect women, especially fictional alien ones. All right. We already went to my number two, so what is your number two?
My number two is Mass Effect 2. So we did both of our numbers.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay. What is your number one?
Okay. My number one is the
Wait, what was your number three? I feel like we skipped one of yours.
Walking Dead.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, can I name my... Okay, just really quickly. Honorable mentions that didn't make into the list.
Sure.
Portal. Portal didn't make it onto the list. GLaDOS is hands down, I think, bar none, the greatest villain in video games history.
Yeah, she's amazing. I would accept that. That's fine.
And then Smash Bros. Didn't make my list either.
Yeah.
Smash Bros. Is just really fun, but yeah. There's no room for it on my top five. Okay, my number one is the only Japanese RPG to make it onto my list.
I didn't have one. Yeah, go ahead.
I gave it some thought, and I think this is not only my favorite game of all time, but I will fight you, it's the greatest video game of all time. I have spent more hours on this game than any game in existence. And
so what do you think of the main female character's boob size is what I want to
no,
ask.
No, you're wrong. It's not that game.
Oh, okay, it's not this game. I thought it was Final
and
Fantasy
VII. And this will give it away. It? I think, again, bar none, I think it has the best end game content because you beat this game and you find out there's an entire other game.
Oh, I actually don't know what this is.
So, my number one pick is Pokemon Gold and Silver.
Okay, that totally deserves to be on there. That is a fantastic game. I actually remember that about that game. Yeah, that moment at the end where you realize you can go back to Kanto
yeah.
is so great. And those games are perfect. Side note about them, Pokemon is a beautiful thing. I think it's really cool in our culture. I like the like culture that developed around Pokemon Go, and in the last few days a bunch of artists online have started doing something called gym leader personas, which are pieces of art where they draw what they would look like as a stylized gym leader from a Pokemon game, and it's so fun. It's so cool to see like
super
diverse and talented people like putting out this kind of self-portrait of themselves a little bit and like nerd fandom. It struck me. I was very, that makes me very happy. I can't even fully articulate what makes me happy about it, but it feels very sweet and pure.
It does. It's pure. It's pure is a perfect word for it.
Yeah. There's no like weird I mean, we're in such a world of fucking politics everywhere right now that I want to scream, and it's just like a cool thing. That's it.
Has there ever been like a lame toxic culture around, I mean, I'm sure there is if you dig for it, but like
around Pokemon?
I think because it's so ubiquitous and it's so just like nondescript as far as like,
I think it's because it's ubiquitous though. I think there's probably equal amounts of shitty Pokemon fans as anyone else, but I agree that it does not immediately inform that world as much as it does with some other kinds of fandom, for sure.
The closest I can think is, I remember like when Pokemon Go came out, people were getting really weird about their gym alignment, their team alignment.
Yeah, that's just like people being dumb. Like I drove by the park last week and there was people taking a gym down together. That game is still going strong. I'm not playing it, but still going strong, and it was just fun to see.
So, and listen, if you chose Team Yellow, you deserve to be ridiculed as much as you're ridiculed. So.
I don't even remember what I was. I don't think I was yellow, but okay, my number one, I have a quick story about it, and I think I've told you this story before, so you're gonna know. The first time I ever played this game, I wept openly at the end of it. It is the most beautiful game I've ever played in my life. Its story is astounding. People have talked for years about making it into a movie, and I think that's a really stupid choice because this is a movie. It's a playable movie. It's super fun. The mechanics are really fun. A lot of games that are like that with lots of cutscenes and story to them don't feel like video games. This is a good video game. It's also a video game that Bobby has never played. And I once subbed for my roommate Shannon's class. We're both college professors, and we taught at the same school at this time, so I subbed for one of her classes for her. And I was in the middle of introducing myself when one of her students, a 19-year-old girl, raised her hand and said, "Excuse me, you're Mr. Ross?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Are you the one that cries at video games?" in front of the whole class. So Shannon had told her entire class about that, and I still stand by it. I said what the game was, and half the people in the room nodded very seriously and said, oh, yes, yes, we understand. What is this game, Bobby?
So I have a question, though. Is yeah. Is three the Call of Duty where you take down the where you hijack the airplane?
Yeah, yeah, that's the one I'm talking about. I'm specifically talking about that level. I hate you so much.
It's The Last of Us.
I am, of course, talking about Last of Us, which I still to this day believe to be the most impressive video game I have ever played in my life. Part of what I loved so much about God of War is that it reminded me in a lot of ways of Last of Us. Although Last of Us is more, in terms of gameplay, a shooter and a stealth game, they deal with very similar themes. And they're themes that I'm very interested in. I am very much like a person who's bothered by toxic masculinity, but to see toxic masculinity have to detoxify itself in the presence of a calming force is always going to be interesting for me in characters. And I just like the gruff old guy who's being forced to walk through the world with somebody who hasn't seen the hardships of it. I think that's really, really compelling.
Cool.
And that's what this game is. So
yeah,
it's
a game I'm gonna play soon. So.
Yeah. So we eventually, very, very much eventually, because there's no time limit on this. But Bobby,
I think we're gonna do it in a couple.
I am going to say that it can be as eventually as you need it to be, because it's not fair for me to suggest a 20-hour video game for this podcast. So
in three episodes, we will do this.
All right. Well, if we don't, I'm fine with that. But Bobby very graciously agreed to play this game at some point in the near future so that we can
talk about the things I do for this podcast.
I know.
Playing a video game.
I know.
Ugh.
All right. Well, I think we did good. And we only had one crossover.
It was the one I thought we were going to overlap.
Yeah, that was the one I would have guessed most as well.
We overlapped on the same spot, though. That's kind of weird.
Yeah, that is very weird. You're right. What was your number one?
Pokemon.
Pokemon's better number one.
I don't know
if that's true, but it's definitely more. I mean, Pokemon's undeniable. That's like a less obvious Mario. Like, not everyone would think of it, but the second you say it, you're like, oh, well, yeah, that has to be on the list. It also is. I was trying to think of a JRPG that I would put on this list, and JRPGs are always so weird to me that I never fully enjoy them, but this is a JRPG. I always forget that Pokemon is that, and it's perfect. I agree with you. So
I've sort of turned on JRPGs in recent years, probably unfairly, just because I'm like, they're messy and boring.
Eventually,
and
you get tired of talking about crystals and light. That's just, you know.
And Pokemon is a JRPG that just throws out its story and goes like, do you want to go fight monsters? And I'm like, yes, I do. Yeah. I do want to fight monsters.
All right, man. Well, hey, we kept it under 2 hours.
Yeah, you know, as long as we do on the weeks you have to edit, I'm fine.
Yeah, what the hell? Why does this keep happening when it's my turn? Oh, man.
I would have definitely said no to that final segment if it was on my week.
Oh, man.
All right, so I am not having you pick anything for next week. I am just straight up giving you a thing.
Bobby, my heart is broken.
I know. Okay, where do you want to travel? Do you want to travel Arlington, Virginia, or Arlington, Virginia?
Okay, Arlington, Virginia, please.
Okay, well, I'm going to assign you a Marvel comic.
Uh-huh.
It is The Vision. Vision being the magical robot who's part of the Avengers.
Yes. Eventually, by the way, we are going to talk about Infinity War. I figure we should wait till next time get a chance.
Jesus,
to see it,
we didn't talk about Infinity
War. Yeah, I actually thought we were going to talk about it last time, and then I was happy we didn't, because I think it was too soon after it came out. But yeah, eventually.
So anyway, I'm assigning you Tom King's 12-issue run on The Vision.
Who is currently watching writing Batman, and who I'm very interested to read his Batman as well. I've never read any Tom King, so I'm looking forward to this.
I've only read The Vision. It is a self-contained arc. And it is about the Vision trying his best to settle down and have a domesticated suburban life in Arlington, Virginia, with his wife and his two kids who he has created. So, it's great. And there's a little bit of crossover with Runaways too.
Okay,
so
okay, that's fun. I'm looking forward to that. Have I told you what my pick is specifically yet?
No, you've not.
So
this
my pick is something that I am risking again, because while I was watching Preacher, I went on a kick of Garth Ennis, who is, in my mind, one of the most talented and hardest to enjoy writers in comic books. His stuff is so character-driven and is so impressive that I cannot believe it sometimes. But he, like I said, he's got that sense of humor that hits some edges. So I gave you something that's probably his most palatable mainstream work. And it's also probably something that you could not care less about the character. And I'm going to try to show you with this example why the character can be good, or why comics about this character can be good. It's a 12 issue Punisher series. It's called Welcome Back, Frank. Now, Garth Ennis has written a lot of Punisher, so this is very specifically a 12-issue series called Welcome Back, Frank. If you have the Marvel Beyond app or whatever it's called, what's it called?
Unlimited
app. I believe it's Punisher Volume 4. It's like, again, there's another series, Volume 5, that these two same creators did. So make sure you just read the 12-issue Welcome Back, Frank storyline, because the next one, in my opinion, is not as good. This is written by Garth Ennis, and it is drawn by Steve Dillon, who are the two creators of Preacher as well. This is what they did immediately after their run on Preacher.
Cool. I'm looking forward to it.
It has, I would say it is the best representation of the right way to do Punisher that I have ever seen. So, cool. Yeah. All right. Sweet. What do we learn this week, Bobby?
We go really long if we're left in chat.
I think we both get too excited. We need to have lists of one. I think that's what it is. We both need to bring one thing to argue about which one's better.
It's funny because, like, when we realize partway through we're going too long, it's like I gave, like, a full-on speech about Tony Hawk. And Scott's a Pokemon was like, it's really fun, dude.
Well, I think also the higher up we go, the less the world needs us to explain why Pokemon is a good game or whatever. So I think that's part of it too. I think those things just speak for themselves.
All right, man.
All right. Well, thank you everyone for listening to us blather on for 2 hours again. Bobby,
I appreciate you making this long.
All right. I'll talk to you soon.
You're wrong.